Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. And today I am mixing things up. I'm talking to YouTube sensation Ryan Fluff Bruce. And this is a wild story. You guys are going to love this one. These days, Fluff makes videos about guitars and guitar gear. It's his full-time living. He has a YouTube channel called Riffs, Beards, and Gear with some 260,000 YouTube subscribers right now. He also has a ton of Instagram followers. He has made videos that have gone viral. He has done a lot of fun videos where he unboxes and reviews the cheapest guitar or effect he can buy from an online retailer in a given month. And he is really good at his craft. This guy should be hosting his own TV show, although I guess in 2018, why would you slum it and do a TV show that would get fewer viewers than a YouTube channel that you can control on your own? Anyways, the backstory behind Fluff is equally interesting. He edited adult films for a brief period to pay some recording bills. We get into that. He had a good job at Boeing. He loses that job. You'll hear the whole story. It's incredible. I think you will like it, even if you're not into beards or hard rock or metal riffs. Before we get to that, we have a couple of sponsors. Our first sponsor today is Lee Valley Tools. Lee Valley has been servicing the world of craftspeople for decades, but they were often asked for years to build specialty tools for guitar making, and today they are doing that. They carry everything you need to make an instrument, from construction through to finishing and setup. You can visit leevalley.com for their full line of guitar making products, as well as many other quality woodworking tools. And just to sweeten the deal, they sent me a few $25 gift certificates, and I'm going to give one away to somebody listening to this week's podcast. All you got to do is email us at fretboardjournal@gmail.com with the subject line Lee Valley, and I will pick someone at random and give them a $25 off coupon for Lee Valley. Our second sponsor is Retrofret Vintage Guitars, which has to be one of the great vintage guitar stores in the world. And though I am always telling you guys to make a pilgrimage to their Brooklyn showroom, if you're listening to this podcast during the last week of August 2018, do not do that. They're moving this week to a new space in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood. So wait till they reopen, check out their new space, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you, hit them up for any repair and restoration work you may need, and try out some of that amazingly cool inventory. If you cannot make it to New York or you're just lazy, I can tell you, they just posted a gorgeous 1952 Fender Champion lap steel, a 50 Gibson ES-125, and a pair of Larson Brothers six-string guitars that look incredible, plus a lot more. So go to retrofret.com, see their full inventory, and if you do reach out to them, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Before we get to my talk with Fluff, there are some new videos on fretboardjournal.com you should check out, including the singer-songwriter Joe Henry, fingerstyle guitar great Mark Hansen, and a bunch more. If you ordered the Fretboard Journal's first ever electric guitar annual, I want to thank you for your order and for your patience. It grew. We thought it was going to be 128 pages, just like the regular Fretboard Journal magazine, but it somehow ballooned up to 144 pages because I didn't want to cut anything. And so we hit a few production snafus. We had to cram a little bit more in there. There was a little bit extra design, but it is going to be printed next week and we'll be mailing out in the second week of September. So if you want it, and I think you should want it because it has features on Ry Cooder, Grover Jackson, a ton of never before stories from the early history of Fender guitars and more, you can go to fretboardjournal.com and hit the shop tab and you will see it there and you can reserve your copy. But you should act fast because they've actually been selling quite well and I'm not printing a ton of them. These are a limited edition thing and they're selling quickly, so act fast. Beyond that, I hope everybody has a great, safe Labor Day weekend. Don't be like me and attempt to ride your kid's bike while holding another kid's bike. It's a recipe for danger. I got a little scuffed up, but I am okay. I have a few new scars now on my face. Anyways, I hope you enjoy my talk with Ryan Fluff Bruce. I certainly did, and have a great long weekend, everybody. So, Fluff, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Thanks for having me, man.
And, you know, you really weren't on my radar, I gotta be honest, till recently, but I feel like every other recommended YouTube video has been one from your channel, which is Riffs, Beards, and Gear. And then I started poking around, I'm like, God, this guy's got a huge following. You're in the Pacific Northwest. Like, were you one of the rare guys who were born and raised here?
Yeah, I was born in Renton and raised in Federal Way.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now based now sort of near Tacoma?
Yeah, I'm right next to Cheney Stadium, so like kind of deep Tacoma, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me your story. When did guitars come into your life?
I grew up, so I'm an old guy. So I was 14 in 1994 when the grunge thing really, really took off in the Seattle area. And I was kind of really affected by that. And I was a huge, you know, grunge kid. And I loved Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains. And I had a friend, I was kind of interested in guitar, but I was kind of afraid to dive in. And then I had one of those friends in junior high whose mom was really, really cool. And she would take her to all sorts of shows. And one time they're like, hey, we're going to Seattle at this festival that they have every year called Pain in the Grass. And it was in Seattle Center, I'm sure you remember. And it was a free show put on by KSW. And all these crazy bands used to play, like, you know, in the early 90s, you can go and see Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains for free.
Wow.
By this time, it was super Seattle typical for the 90s. It was a band called Grunt Truck, which toured and did the Super Unknown Soundgarden tour. And they were a huge, huge band. And they were signed, one of the first bands signed to Roadrunner Records.
Yeah.
And I saw them live, and that was just kind of it for me. I was like, I want to do that. Like this is like the most insane thing I've ever seen. And from there, I decided to start playing guitar.
Yeah. And you say you're like 14, 15. What was that first guitar?
So the very, very, very first guitar was an old 70s Yamaha acoustic that my grandmother gave me, which I still wish I had, but, being dumb and in high school, I think I gave it to somebody or something like that. Someone who was taking lessons, I gave it to them because they needed it more than I did. My first proper electric guitar was a Parts Warmoth guitar, which was actually a set neck guitar from the 70s that my uncle had built in like 77, 78.
Wow.
And it had all brass hardware, and it basically looked like a Les Paul Jr., and it was a really, really amazing guitar, and it had, you know, DiMarzio Super Distortions. It was so 70s. And I was getting really, really bad grades in junior high because I wanted to spend all my time playing guitar. And by that time, I had gotten a Fender Strat, which I still have. And my dad, as punishment for my grades, took that guitar and sold it without telling me.
Damn, that's harsh.
Yeah, and he kept the money, which I had paid for myself. Wow. And I still have never let him live this down. And he has said sorry a million times.
I mean, I know as a dad, we're all kind of winging it. I know I am, but that yes. Seemed particularly harsh.
It was. He looked at it as, you know, I had two guitars by the time I was 15 years old. And he was like, you don't need a second one, and you're getting really crappy grades. And so one day I came home, and my guitar simply wasn't there anymore. Wow. So what did you do with my guitar? And he just took it to work and sold it, kept the money. So I wish I could find that guitar again. I have since tried to track down his coworker, and I don't know where he's at anymore. But yeah, that was a cool guitar.
Yeah, and forming bands at an early age too, or just kind of playing in a bedroom?
No, I was actually in a band. It was a few years until I was in a band, but yeah, I was in a band in high school. And by the time I hit junior in high school, I was playing gigs every weekend. It was pretty bad. Actually, it was a sophomore year in high school. We had a pretty crappy band, but we were really into it. And then by the time I got to senior year in high school, I was 17 and I was in a hardcore punk band because I had discovered punk rock at that point. And I just wanted to play faster, louder, and so angry at the world. And we were playing shows two or three times every single weekend for a year and a half and just doing it.
Wow.
And it was awesome. Like that was my first part of my adult life is just playing shows.
I'm guessing, maybe my timeline's way off, but by the time you were a senior in high school, had grunge kind of already peaked and imploded, and you were
This is about 98, 99.
Sure.
So the new metal thing was happening, rap metal, that kind of thing. But I went totally the opposite way because I really wasn't into most of that stuff. And I discovered a lot of underground punk by, off the Epitaph Records label.
Sure.
And Fat Records, Fat Mike's label and stuff like that. So I just went totally into punk rock. And if it wasn't fast, I didn't want to hear it.
And venue-wise, are you having to drive to Seattle or Olympia for gigs that are all ages, or you're kind of playing wherever?
Yeah, actually, a place that we used to play a lot, because he was so ultimately cool, was another local guy named Grady Whalen, who's currently fronts a band called Acid Teeth, and he owned a venue called Auburn's Best Annex way back in the day, and he was so supportive of the scene, still is, and he would just let us come and play whenever we wanted to play. And so we were playing there a lot. We were going to Seattle. We would play college campuses. We would play, down in Olympia. We played in Lakewood. We played all over the place. Wherever we could get a gig, we would pretty much play it. And most of the time, even if we were offered a little bit of money, we would just skip it and just say, no, we'll pay for free. Just give us a better slot in the show. And that's what we did. Yeah. It was awesome.
Did you go to college?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to I paid for a year out of my own pocket for a local community college, Green River. Mm-hmm. And it was this is right out of high school. So I graduated in 99, and the .com thing had happened, and it was just kind of starting to collapse.
Yeah.
And I was really good at designing my friends' websites, and I designed websites for bands at the time, and I had a couple of local colleges, and I had the Art Institute of Seattle ask me hey, you should come attend, and we'll give you a discount, but it's still a ton of money and I couldn't afford it still. And so I just decided to go to Green River for database management and website design. And that was when my teacher knew some guys who started some website called Google, which was a ridiculous name at the time. And I find that incredibly boring. And I quit because one day I just couldn't find parking. And I thought, you know what? I paid for this, so I can say I don't want to go anymore. And I didn't go anymore.
Deciding based on parking spaces.
I got so tired of parking so far away. And at this particular day, I literally had to park 2 miles away. I was a mile away from the bus stop. And I just thought, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Dang. now I know you do a fair amount of work, like doing engineering and stuff. Were you in the studios at an early age and kind of figuring that out, or did that come later?
Actually, that came later, but interestingly enough, when I was 16, I was trying to record at my parents' house with the family desktop computer, but the technology in 1996 just did not allow that.
Yeah.
And I went to, my first recording experience was going to the Central Washington University with my Uncle Mike, and my Uncle Mike is a huge audio guy from way back, and he had his own mastering studio. But at that time, he was going to college for his audio engineering degree, and he had full access to the college's recording studio. And so over Christmas break in 1996, I went over there for a week in the middle of a snowstorm, and we recorded 3 songs, one of which I had written. And then it was, I think we did 2 Alice in Chains covers or something like that. And that whole process was my first proper introduction. And I always wanted to get into it, but I just did not have the means because, just like I said, the technology just wasn't there. And then my punk band that I was talking about did a record with the guys in another local band called Seaweed, who they were on Sub Pop, and they did a bunch of cool stuff.
Yeah.
We recorded here in Tacoma, not too far from where I live now, which was really, really cool. We recorded on the Rage Against the Machines mixing console that they used for their first record that was in their practice space. And I just found that kind of nerdy stuff really, really fascinating. So when we would be in the studio, I would be with the guy recording everything, and I wanted to know how everything worked, whereas the rest of the guys wanted to go play video games and go screw off with, you know, seeing what food is around and stuff like that. And that just didn't interest me. So it was always a bug, but I just didn't have any means to really exploit it until much later, about 2010.
Okay.
I would say.
And let's just get into your little multimedia empire here. sure. When did the idea for Riffs, Beards, and Gear come into play, and what was your thought process?
A big turning point for me. So I was a totally different guy about a decade ago. I didn't know I had sleep apnea.
Okay.
And I got married, started a family. I went and got a normal desk job at Boeing, and I was just so damn tired all the time. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed that everybody, everyone felt that way. And then one day I was at the dentist and they were like, you know, you have the biggest tonsils we have ever seen. You should really go get that checked out. And I thought, that's interesting. And that also is probably why I woke up hungover every day, even though I wasn't drinking. I just used to wake up with these severe hangovers because of lack of oxygen, because I was choking in my sleep and I didn't know it.
Wow.
And so I have the surgery. I'm going to truncate a long story.
Yeah, go for it.
And I have surgery, and overnight I have just an indescribable amount of energy and drive, and that I've never had in my entire life. And I'm about 29, 30 at this point, about 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm done cleaning the entire house. What else do I want to do? Like, I have all this energy. And man, I always wanted to get into recording. I love that process of songwriting and getting it down and possibly changing it in post when you're working on the actual waveforms. I just love that on a really, really deep level. Even though I had never even done it before, but I used to sit there and just watch videos and documentaries about that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know what? Why not just go for it? And by this time, I started looking into it, and a lot of things had changed in home recording technology since the mid-90s.
Sure.
unbeknownst to me. So I kind of just dove in, and I bought a used Line 6 interface off of eBay for $50, and off I went. And when I was wanting to learn all of these things, the difference, I guess, for me was I wasn't a 20-year-old kid with no resources. I was working a job at Boeing at the time, and I had resources. I had money.
Yeah.
But I still didn't know. But that doesn't matter if you don't know what you're doing. So I wanted to know how to work with this stuff. And I would contact these guys on YouTube, and it was like some secret society. I wanted to know how to do things like reamp and do, you know, set your levels for recording. And no one would tell me anything. I have my specific way, but I don't really want to talk about how I do that. And I remember being really angry about, like, you know, oh, God forbid I sound good too. Like, cause that's not what it's about. It's about expressing yourself, and everyone should be allowed to sound good, in my opinion.
Sure.
And, it's not some competitive thing. That's not what music is for me. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to find out all of the deepest secrets of all of this stuff, and I'm going to just tell everybody. And that's what I did. And slowly, over years of just trial and error, being in my bubble, I just learned how to record at home. And yeah, it just kind of took off from there. And then I posted a video just as an answer to a forum argument, because apparently arguments happen on forums. Go figure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I posted a video of a microphone shootout, and it got 100 views in like a week. And I thought, oh my God, I don't even know 100 people. Like, that's crazy. I didn't post it anywhere, and it got shared around. And I found it really, really fun, but introducing video to that recording medium came pretty easy to me, because I had briefly recorded, or I had briefly edited video professionally in California years earlier.
Pre-Boeing. So,
pre-Boeing, yeah. Okay. My last band thing before I gave it all up and went to the family life was I moved down to California with my band at the time, and we recorded a record at a famous studio called Sound City.
Sure.
And in order to in order to pay the bills, I had lied and I had said I knew how to edit video and ended up getting a job editing adult movies to pay the studio bills because it paid really, really well. And I thought, well, you know, $1,500 a day. Yeah, sure. I can do whatever you'd like me to do. And that was edit in Final Cut Pro on a Mac G5 in 2005. And I learned as I went, and it was a lot of fun editing video and taking the video and cutting and splicing. And it wasn't too dissimilar from audio. So that's why I think I didn't have many reservations jumping into the audio part a decade later, or, you know, 5 years later or whatever. And so combining those two things with this thing called YouTube was just all, I don't know, it was a whole new world for me. It was a lot of fun.
I'm not going to let you just gloss over the fact that you're editing adult movies. So these were
I didn't know what kind, you know, I don't know how far to go there.
So does the, I'm assuming these films have a director? Does the director giving you input on like, here's where the close-up mm-hmm. is and cut here and cut there?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So at that time, it's changed a little bit because this is right when the digital transformation was kind of happening. At this time, they were filming everything on digital Sony DV tapes. And then they would bring us a shoebox full of these tiny mini cassettes. And we would then fly them to digital on a little tape deck. And you would just pop them in the machine, and you basically had to hang out for an hour while it digitally copied everything over onto the computer, and then you would dump everything into the editing software and edit a 2-hour adult movie, and then have a two hours of behind the scenes and extras for the second DVD. And the directors were financing everything at that time, but I worked primarily for Red Light District, who came out with all the, you know, all the celebrity sex tapes and all that kind of stuff. And once you had a rough edit, you would call the director, and then they would then come over and change the cut there. And it was very just kind of an informal process. And once it's done, you export it out, gave them the file, and they gave you a check. That was it.
Did you get to pick the cheesy music that backed all this action?
Yep. Nice. Sure did.
You get a whole, is there like a whole library of just, what was it back then? It wouldn't be cassette tapes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was royalty free. We had a CD, a burned CD of royalty free stuff that we were allowed to use. I helped on a video that was nominated for an Adult Video Network, an AVN award. So we got to go to Vegas. I got to go to Las Vegas for my first time ever because we were nominated for Best Editor.
Nice work. Really
cool. Yeah, it was fun. Like, we got to high five Puff Daddy and Tommy Lee and stuff. It was cool.
Were you able to tell your mom that you were doing this?
So that's a funny story. So I was down in LA for almost a year, and I wouldn't. So they're like, well, what are you doing for work? And, and, you know, being guys, like, I would come up, I left in July. I came up back home in the Seattle area in November, and I wouldn't tell my mom, but I told my dad, because you can tell dad that kind of stuff.
Sure. He still owes you from that guitar thing.
Right.
Yeah.
and my dad was like, but you're not in the movies. And I'm like, no, I strictly edit, I put, you know, titles on, and I splice the cuts and all that stuff. And he was like, well, okay, well, I mean, that's cool. I mean, if that's an honest buck, we thought you were dealing drugs. Like, we didn't know. And so it was only after I got back from California, I told my mother, and she was apprehensive but relieved at the same time. And her first question was also, well, were you in the movies? And I went, no. That's a whole separate thing. I'm strictly behind the scenes editing the footage and making the DVD. Oh, okay. Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fine with that.
Your nickname didn't come out of this chapter, did it?
No. Okay. So, So what the funny part with that is I used to edit, and the directors used to sit there. So like one of the directors was a guy called Manuel Ferreira.
Okay. And they never have real names, right?
This is his real name. Okay. He's one of the most award-winning performers and directors. He got into directing, and he's still a director and is still in the industry to this day. And he'd only been in it a few years at that point, and he used to sit next to me, and he was from France, so he used to sit there and go, so I do not understand. Your name is Fluff, but it is not from the movies? I don't understand how you get called Fluff.
Foreshadowing, dude.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. No, Fluff came from my the punk rock band in the late 90s when okay. I have bleached 90s hair.
Got it. All right. Well, we'll continue the video thread here. On your bio, it says you are a professional YouTuber. Now, I know you have a ton of followers. Were you able to quit the job at Boeing? And is this like your full-time gig?
It is my full-time gig. So the funny story behind that was about, I guess it was 3 years ago now, almost exactly. In fact, I was going through a divorce, and about 3 weeks after that process started, I was fired from Boeing for going on to Amazon.com outside of my lunch break. Ooh. And by that yeah. time, I had been there for almost a decade, flawless service. But I was at a very high level job at that point and was making a lot of money. And the short of it is a manager, I was snarky to, not my manager, but someone else's manager. I was snarky, and he decided to have his revenge. And so he reported me erroneously for something I didn't do. And in knowing that in that process of investigating me, they would look at my internet activity, which everyone's surfing the internet at 3 o'clock in the morning at Boeing.
Sure.
But because I got singled out, I got in trouble, and I was actually fired on the spot without warning, and I was just suddenly walked out. So like my life just literally crashed in the span of about 3 weeks. It was
damn
unbelievably awesome in the worst way. So when at that point I had a friend just say, you know, sometimes, man, the life just pushes you in the pool, and it's up to you to choose to swim or to drown. And I thought, well, if I'm gonna lose my ass at doing something, it's gonna be doing what I love to do. So I'm just gonna make a go at this YouTube thing full time, and see if I can get some industry jobs, because I've always wanted to just be exclusively in the music industry. And I couldn't think of anything else to do, so I made this video called Life Vlog, and just basically I made a video telling all my viewers like what was going on in my life. And if you look at the video, I look completely shocked, because I literally got home from getting fired and just shot a video going, I don't know what's going to happen, guys. I don't know if I'm going to lose the house. I don't know. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. So out of that, I had a couple of job offers from some companies I'd worked with for videos in the past. And I just I withdrew $50,000 in the retirement fund I had and lived off that until I righted the boat about 4 or 5 months later.
Wow.
And here I am. Worked out.
I've watched a ton of your videos. I mean, thanks, some man. Of them have a million plus views. Mm-hmm. Can you make a living off of just YouTube royalties these days?
It's very, very difficult. So usually, I mean, I don't solely.
Yeah.
But what YouTube is turning into, it's turning into the new TV, but as a result, it's really a visual resume to do other stuff. So when you go and actually do something that you really want to do, you can just go, well, here's the other thing I did. For example, I've had several jobs. I was the head of marketing, North American marketing, for a company called Positive Grid, who makes guitar apps for like the iPhone, mm-hmm. and you know, they make an app and stuff like that. But now I am I'm the artist relations guy for Joey Sturgis Tone's plugins, JST plugins, and I worked directly with a famous producer named Joey Sturgis, who did a bunch of metalcore records back in the 2000s, 2008 through 2013, Asking Alexandria and multi-platinum guys. And he makes his own plugins now. And as a result, he saw what I was doing on YouTube, and I built my own brand from nothing. And he's basically like, hey man, you want a job? You want to travel and like hang out with rock stars and go to shows for a living? I was like, yes, I do. Absolutely. So YouTube is kind of just a visual resume. You can make a living at it. Like my bandmate, Jared Dines, who's a very, very, very famous YouTuber. He has millions and millions of subs. He makes a living just solely off YouTube views.
Did you guys meet through YouTube?
No, we met before that. He actually lived a mile from me. Okay. And he was running a small studio out of his parents' house, and was just recording bands 13 hours a day, 7 days a week. And just made a video that he thought was funny, and he ended up having, you know, Pink Floyd shared the video, Lamb of God shared the video. I mean, it just went hyper, hyper viral. And he's an incredibly smart dude, and he's really, really funny. And he just kept that train rolling. And 3 years, 4 years later, he's one of the kings of YouTube. It's crazy.
You guys have like a little empire going on down there.
Kind of, yeah. And then our guitarist Tony manages both of us. And then we started the band right when I lost my job. So that's kind of tied into everything. And it's just kind of this, we got a little thing going on up here. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like your output is insane. Are you, barring any of these like great jobs you keep landing, are you shooting every day?
Pretty much. Yeah. I usually will kind of make a mental note of what I kind of want to happen over the weekend. And then I try to not work on the weekends, and come Monday, I'll get my iPad out and start writing down, okay, here's the things I need to do this week. And either sometimes I'll shoot 3 videos in a day and then take the next day off. Sometimes I'll just feel really, I mean, cause you don't feel 100% on it all of the time. I mean, everybody has the, I don't feel like doing anything today kind of a thing, but which the danger there is I don't have to do anything every day if I don't want to, but obviously there would be repercussions there down the road. So I have to stay motivated. So that's when I'll switch and maybe do a different video idea, or this company wants me to check out this amp, so I'll make a video for that amp. Or
I was going to say, you're probably at this point getting sent gear to review the way a guitar magazine is.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. 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 I don't hit up anybody.
It's awesome. Cool. And do you know in your head before you're shooting, like, oh, I can tell this video is going to be one of the million view ones? Like, I mean, I think you found the cheapest electric you could find on Amazon, and that was probably one of your more popular videos?
That's probably the most popular video I've ever had. Yeah. And that was this last November. And honestly, I wish I could say you can tell what's going to be big, but you can't. It's you have no idea. So some of the videos that I'll spend a lot of time on,
yeah,
no one cares. And then that, like, I was actually feeling really burnt out when I made the cheapest guitar on Amazon. And I thought, I'm going to do something that I think is just fun to make. And it was my way of just kind of blowing off steam. And I put it out. And my channel wasn't doing particularly well at that time. I was kind of in a slump. I was just bored, and I was just kind of over the whole thing. And I put it out, and it just went absolutely nuts from like the get-go. Like, it had, I mean, my videos will do okay. They do, you know, 15 or 20,000 views or something like that. But this one got like by the end of the first day, it had like 100,000 views. And I was like, well, that's weird. Okay, well, cool. You know, that was a good idea. And then the next day I got another 100,000, and I was like, whoa, this doesn't normally happen to me. And then it just kept going for like weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. It just kept getting shared around. So that kind of rejuvenated me, I think.
Yeah.
That made me feel, I don't know, not as boxed in, because when you're doing gear stuff, you tend to feel over time boxed in by, well, no, they're not going to like, for example, like a lot of my viewers are really, really hardcore metalheads. So when I break out the 62 reissue custom shop Fender Jaguar, they're like, oh God, here we go, dad guitar.
See, that's what our readers would live for. It's totally opposite. Yeah.
And it's interesting how your tastes change as you get older. Because when I started it, I was playing 7 strings when I started the channel all those years ago. I was playing Schecter 7 strings, and now I play 70s Gibsons and, like, you know, custom shop Fenders. And
don't you have a signature model guitar too?
I do have a signature model, which is just one of the most incredible things. And it's really, really awesome.
What's the story behind that?
Well, at the time, I really, really have always loved, a favorite guitar of mine since I started playing was a guitar called a Gibson RD.
Yep.
Which were kind of weird, and only 1,500 of them were originally made in the late 70s. I mentioned this, that I've always wanted to find one, on an FAQ Monday, which is like a regular video series I have every Monday where I answer some questions. And someone messaged me and they're like, hey man, one of those RD things that you mentioned is on Craigslist in the Seattle area. And I thought, well, that's an incredible stroke of luck, because I mean, they just don't ever come up for sale because they're so rare. And sure enough, there was a first year 77 standard in the local Craigslist by some collector guy, and I went out and bought it, and it was the most incredible thing I had ever played. And I found another one about a year later. I found an RD Artist, which is the top tier finish or trim level, also a 77 first year model. And I was playing those and the band started and I was gigging with the Artist. But the thing is with the 40-year-old Gibson guitars is they don't tend to be very stable as far as tuning goes.
Sure.
And the heat and the lights and all that stuff. I didn't want to tour with a 40-year-old guitar. And so Joe Balaguer, whom I had known through mutual friends, he had started Balaguer Guitars, and all of his guitars are kind of, they're vintage minded with modern amenities and modern features. And he kind of just, he gets it as far as what is right with the old stuff, but also what is wrong with the old stuff.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey man, I'll make anything you want. Like, you want to do a signature model? I was like, yeah, I do. That would be awesome. And he's like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, if you could design me something that would be comparable to these RDs, but make them even better. And because one of them, my gigging RD, I had customized to hell. And he was just like, yeah, we can do all that stuff stock. Like Tone Pros Bridge and, you know, the good locking tuners and good pickups. Stainless steel frets was a huge one that I really wanted. And Joe has never, ever told me no. And yeah, I'll be with him for many, many years to come. I've been with him for 2 years now.
Yeah.
And the guitar has done really well. And that was kind of along the same line. One of my favorite bands is a band called Ghost. And they played RDs, reissue RDs at that time. So in parallel, the RD was getting a lot of awareness. And I was really happy to kind of be a part of that and just kind of bring that into people's consciousness today.
Yeah. What happens to all the cheap gear you buy on Amazon for these unboxing videos? Do you just sell it on Craigslist?
No, usually I give it away.
Yeah.
Honestly. I still have the cheapest guitar on Amazon in the corner next to me, next to my mixing desk, just to remind me that big things can come from not expensive stuff.
Nice.
Because I like to stay humble. But I'm a huge believer in paying it forward. So like a lot of the stuff that I get in the videos, inexpensive or not, I do end up just kind of giving to friends, or, you know, I'll do a contest, I'll do a giveaway and give it to someone who really actually needs it. Cause I mean, I got 20 guitars. Like, I don't need another guitar.
Yeah.
So,
well, and it looks like you now have a full on recording studio. I don't know if that's in your house or where you film, but, it looks pro. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a room. It's basically a post-production room. I can track vocals. I have the ability to track pretty much anything, and I don't do a lot of, I can track drums, but I prefer to take that somewhere else if I'm tracking a band or doing a record or something like that. But for the most part, everything is here just right where I'm sitting in, at the desk, just because it has to be visually appealing, because it's kind of a hybrid studio, because it's not just for audio and it's not just for video. So I have to be conscious of both those things when I was setting it up.
Sure.
And I recently moved. Me and the lady bought a house in January.
Nice. Congrats. So
thanks.
And small feet in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah. And it's been a cool ride. My old place is where all this started, and I started in just a bedroom and started with the Sony Cybershot and some Logitech desktop speakers and a Gateway computer. And it's pretty crazy that now, you know, I have this actual mixing desk and rack gear and a cinema camera that I film with. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Life's weird, man.
No, it's cool too that you're, you know, through the Amazon links, you're telling everybody how you're making these things, which is rad.
Yeah. 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 Totally.
I guess through that, you probably know how many of those cheapest guitars actually sold on Amazon because of you.
I do. Yeah. Actually, from that video, I actually had Amazon contact me. I actually had a rep call me and go, "Who are you? Like, you just spiked our influencer program. Like, you have, we just got like 500,000 impressions over the last 3 weeks. Like, who the hell are you?" So it's like, "Hi, Amazon. Can I get free Prime or anything?"
Yeah.
They're like, "No. No, you can't."
You know, they were kind of they were kind of the reason you lost your cush job at Boeing.
They were, actually. You know what? I should tell them that. I should blame them. No, I shouldn't.
So how many sold roughly?
You know what? I don't know how many. It's been a while since I've looked. But
like thousands, hundreds?
No, it was over 1,000.
Wow.
But I think that's over the course of 6 months or something like that.
Yeah.
But a lot of people went and looked at it and checked it out and or bought something similar, like maybe a slightly better version of that guitar.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But it was substantial. I mean, I think God, I don't even know what the percentage is off the top of my head, but Amazon gave me a really healthy check 2 months later.
Nice.
Yeah, it was cool.
So last question, where do you see all this heading? Where's your channel going? What's next for the Fluff Empire?
Right now the band the band that I have with Jared just got back from a 6-week US tour, which was incredible. And we're writing for that record. As far as the YouTube stuff go, I don't know. I think I'm just going to keep trudging along and doing what I think is fun. And right now the climate has really changed. So I'm kind of evaluating what I want to do, because it used to be, "Hey, check out this super nerdy gear thing." And now it's clickbaity titles and really bright, loud thumbnails. And people want their content right now. So it's going away from the educational stuff and going more towards the cheapest guitar on Amazon and things like that. So I have to find a balance that I think is satisfying for me.
Yeah.
Because I like the nerdy stuff, but I do also like the fun stuff. It can't be one or the other. It can't be too much of one thing. So I don't know. I think going forward, it's going to be a little bit of both. And I'm also going to try to do more collaborative stuff. I think that's kind of something a lot of people have been asking for.
Yeah.
So let's keep doing my thing.
All right. Well, if you ever find yourself in Seattle's Ballard neighborhood and want to talk shop, we can figure something out.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. I'll hit you up, man.
All right. Thank you so much, Fluff. This was awesome.
Dude, thank you.